Welcome to Smart Habits for Translators, a podcast for translators by translators, bringing you simple strategies to build better habits. In each episode, we will focus on specific habits for translators in various stages of their careers. If you're a translator who enjoys learning about habits to improve your business and lifestyle, then this is the podcast for you. We're your hosts, Madalena Sanchez-Ampalo
and Veronica De Michelis. Like you, we are professional freelance translators trying to balance the challenges that come with building a career and maintaining clarity and boundaries between work and personal life. We hope you'll join us in this conversation about smart habits and discover some simple strategies you can apply today to help you build your career and achieve the lifestyle you desire.
Welcome to Smart Habits for Translators. This is episode 28. We hope you enjoyed our previous episode marking our first podcast anniversary, and we would like to thank you for your support and interest in our podcast. Our goal has always been to share tips and resources for our colleagues who are on the same journey as we are, creating better, smarter habits to find clarity and boundaries between work and personal life. We're so thankful to you for listening and engaging with us online. And we can't wait to see what this next year of podcasting will bring. You can definitely count on exciting new guests and interesting topics related to smart habits. Speaking of, we have a very special guest with us today. As many of you may know, October is International Breast Cancer Awareness Month, so it seemed like a perfect fit for the topic of our conversation today, dealing with and overcoming serious illness, as well as some smart habits that can be helpful if you or someone you know is going through this right now or in the future.
We are very excited to welcome our colleague and friend, Megan Concol. Megan is a freelance ATA-certified French to English translator specializing in marketing and communications, human resources, and international development. She has a master's degree in French to English translation from UW Milwaukee. Prior to starting her freelance business, she worked in-house at a global language services provider as a project manager and French quality manager. Today, Megan especially enjoys working with NGOs in sub-Saharan Africa and immigrants from this region who are relocating to the United States. She currently serves as director on the ATA Board of Directors and leads ATA's school outreach program. Welcome, Megan.
Thank you, and thanks so much for having me on the podcast.
Yes, welcome, Megan. And we've known you for several years through our volunteer work with the American Translators Association. And thanks to your openness in talking about your recent battle with cancer, we've also had the opportunity to witness how brave and strong you've been throughout this experience. When we talked about inviting you as a guest on our podcast several months back, we were a little bit nervous, but we hoped that you'd say yes. We felt that your story is too important not to share with others. And we were also aware that it can be difficult to retell and relive an experience like this. So thanks so much for agreeing to join us for this truly important conversation.
Well, thanks so much. I really appreciate those words. And it's not a problem at all for me to share. I know it can vary a lot from person to person, but speaking from my own perspective, I'm very happy to share. And I know that when I was in the shoes of someone who was kind of thrown into this very unexpectedly and suddenly, I really appreciated hearing really any kind of soaking up any and all information I could from others who had been in that experience too. So I'm kind of hoping to pass it along.
Yeah, pay it forward. Awesome. So let's jump into the conversation by asking you if you can tell us when and how you started your freelance career.
Sure. So as we mentioned in the intro, I did a master's in translation at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. And pretty much right at the beginning of that program, I was told about kind of like the realities of what is the world of translation outside of this program and outside of academia. Mm-hmm. And so I knew pretty early on that freelancing was probably going to be my path. So that was kind of always my end goal. Graduating from that program, I finished in 2010. I felt that I actually was really appreciative of, I had several courses in that program that were focused on things like business aspects and things that weren't necessarily hands-on translation, but other skills that you really need to succeed as a business owner. Mm-hmm. So despite that, I still felt, you know, I think having some kind of like corporate experience might just be like an extra kind of like a cherry on top before I really take that leap into freelancing. So, and I think I knew that that would maybe make the transition a little easier as well from student to like business owner, maybe work in a corporate setting first. So, So I just happened to, you know, I was living in Milwaukee, still am today, but there happened to be a translation company in Milwaukee that was hiring. And so that was my opportunity to kind of get my foot in the door. And I worked there as a project manager and then as a French quality manager. And just kind of that whole time, again, I always knew in the back of my mind that this was helping me towards my end goal, which was freelancing. And so after a few years of working full-time at that company, I felt like, okay, now I'm ready to kind of put the, like, start the motions of preparing to freelance. So mm-hmm. I would say maybe around the 4-year mark, I started really seriously creating a plan. I'm very much a planner when I can be. So I was starting to actually write things down, like, okay, how much do I need to save out of my paycheck every month?
Okay.
The kind of things I have is like my startup funding for my business. On weekends I was doing things like building my website to start marketing my business once it did launch. Mm-hmm. So I was doing all this stuff in my time outside of my my full-time job at the translation company. So I was doing kind of all that prep work for probably about a year. And then I kind of had like a launch date in mind. And then kind of the rest is history. So I had my last day at my full-time job at the translation company. And then pretty much the next Monday was kind of like my launch date of my business.
Wow.
That's so smart on your part.
Yeah. I don't think too many people can say that they did such a transition like that. That's really cool.
Well, I mean, I am happy with how it went. I don't have any regrets. But I'll get into this a little bit later, but that is very, I guess, on brand for me as someone who is somewhat of a perfectionist and I like to have things in control. Mm-hmm. And I felt, from my family, especially being still, you know, I guess in their mind, I was still kind of fresh out of grad school and, hadn't really learned the ways of the world, I guess, as a business owner yet. And so for family members, especially when I told them, you know, I was thinking about making the jump, and some of them were kind of wondering like, oh, well, have you prepared for, you know, things like insurance or, mm-hmm. you know, all these other things that you need to kind of tick the boxes off for. And I was thinking, oh yeah, don't worry. Like, I've been planning this out. Like, you know, it's not going to be perfect. There's always going to be things out of your control, but I've done really, like, I've tried to think of as much as I possibly can to cover my bases before I take this leap. So it definitely was not a spontaneous decision by any means.
Very cool. So what does a typical workday right now look like for you? And obviously with everything going on with the pandemic, everybody's days may not be typical anymore, but what does it look like for you now?
Right. So I would say my schedule isn't super set in stone, but definitely my first priority in the morning, especially, would be getting to my emails, as I do have, I am communicating regularly with individuals located either in Europe or Africa. And so with them being quite a few hours ahead of me, it is important to make sure we discuss anything urgent before they leave the office for the day. Other than that, I would say I try to keep my tasks prioritized or categorized into like various, I guess, buckets of tasks that I could be working on throughout the day. So like my highest priority would be assigned to actual translation work that has a deadline. Then I also try to have a high priority on things like professional development or marketing and administrative tasks. But then I also really try to keep an eye on other tasks that are still important to me, like volunteer work that I do with the American Translators Association. Mm-hmm. I work on several committees there. And then also there's the board of directors has, you know, ongoing emails and tasks that we work on. And then I also volunteer as a translator for an organization called Kiva.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
So I really try and keep a balance. I wouldn't say I do things from each of those categories, you know, on an equal amount every day. Obviously, the translation deadlines would take highest priority. Mm-hmm. So there may be some days where I'm only doing that. But especially with workflow being somewhat unpredictable during the pandemic, I have been able to kind of dedicate more time to some of those other categories as, you know, as appropriate. Mm-hmm. So,
cool.
So I try not to hold myself to too strict of a day-to-day schedule. I would say in the past, I still do. I really do enjoy long-term, like big translation projects that I can just really immerse myself in and kind of get into like a flow state of translating. I mm-hmm. think I work really well that way. The downside to that form of working is that I am guilty of sitting at my desk for long periods of time, like probably barely moving. I mean, if there were a camera on me and I could just watch like a time lapse, I'm sure it would be pretty shocking to see how little I'm moving except for maybe my fingers. And you know, we know that's not healthy. I love getting into that state of mind where I can, it's almost just, you sometimes don't even have to think except for maybe looking, you know, flagging a word to look up or something like that. But it's such a cool state to get in as a translator, but I'm trying to focus more now on, you know, I need to get up and refresh my water or, you know, just do something mindless just to kind of get up for a minute. Mm-hmm. So I am really trying to focus more on that these days as well.
Yeah. And it's a constant battle for me too. Especially these days when, you know, my family members are around a lot more than they used to, like say half a year ago. When I do get those pockets of time to work, if I get into that state where I'm super concentrated and, you know, and I know I have like an hour, 2 hours to do something, mm-hmm. I forget to move. I don't know, you know, it's really hard to be like, oh, I have to get up and move, you know, because you know, it's not, you only have this much time left. Yeah, but it's work in progress. And that leads to our next question. As you know, we like talking about work-life clarity quite a lot on this podcast. And both Madalena and I always share with each other and our guests, and we want to know how our guests do this. You know, how do you define these boundaries, and what does work-life clarity mean to you? So we would like to hear your thoughts on this. How do you try to protect the boundaries between work and personal life, and what do you think about work-life clarity?
Sure. Well, I guess it goes back pretty smoothly to what we were just talking about with you know, just spending so many hours immersed in work, and it's tough as freelancers. And you know, hopefully most of us are lucky to be working on things that we, you know, enjoy and feel are important. So I think we're fortunate in that sense, but it's tough sometimes to draw the line and really prioritize, think about things in terms of like, what do you need to do for your own mental and physical health as well, which is just as important as, you know, having a career and income. So I think in the past, it has been really difficult for me to draw those boundaries. And, you know, I've been guilty of things like, ooh, this really big juicy project that I'm so into. And, you know, I'll just keep working on it because, you know, I'm in that state of mind where I don't want to look away. And now it's way past the time that I would normally be like starting to prepare dinner or, you know, doing some kind of fun thing to get away. So I recently, like in the last couple years, I've really been more conscious of that and just realized, hey, this isn't a matter of not liking my work. You know, I guess I'm trying to silence the like negative voices just from my own head that are saying like, oh, you should feel guilty about stepping away from work, and saying, no, this isn't, you know, this isn't me not, you know, not doing my work seriously or not prioritizing it. This is just also saying, well, I also need to look at my own physical and mental health. And things like something I've seen a lot, especially not translators specifically, but just freelancers in general, there seems to be this kind of language online about like a hustle culture. I am really trying to not support just in my own lifestyle and work style. I love the idea of being passionate about our work and being successful. I think that's great. And I think everyone deserves, you know, to have the time to dedicate to something they love and hopefully be successful at it. But I think especially as a freelancer, there's a fine line between success and letting it get unhealthy and spilling over into habits that are prioritizing more of your like physical and mental health. So whether it's, you know, just doing something that makes you happy or getting out for exercise, I think I'm starting to realize that like, they don't have to compete with each other. I can be really dedicated and really serious about what I do professionally, but also say, well, you know, today I really need to do something else just to, you know, help these other aspects of my life.
Yeah, I love this. What are some smart habits that have been crucial in your career? You know, whether they're related to your work or physical and mental health, relationships, your hobbies?
Yeah, so I wanted to mention this phrase that I've been hearing for years. I probably originally heard it in like probably a yoga class. And it's not something that I would ever, I never disagreed with this phrase, but I would say in recent years, I've really been realizing how true it is. And the phrase is letting go of what no longer serves you. And, you know, this is probably something many of your listeners have heard before, and myself included. And sure, I thought, okay, yeah, that's a nice phrase, you know, maybe just kind of, yeah, I heard it, but I didn't really process it, I guess. And I would say recently this phrase and kind of thinking about it again has had a really big impact on how I approach personal life and work. Again, as freelancers, I think sometimes maybe without meaning to, we can pile up priorities and like certain types of clients or certain type of assignments that sure they're there and they're available, but are they really the best client or the best work for us? Or are we just doing it because something, usually something internal that we're pressuring ourselves to do, we just feel like, yeah, I probably should do that, right? And then if you really stand back and look and evaluate it, maybe it causes you a lot of stress. Maybe the client isn't a great communicator, and every time you interact with them, you just feel like you're just waiting for the next kind of fire that you have to put out. You know, maybe there's a certain type of work where you just really don't agree with the end result of what you're translating, and that can be really problematic. So I think taking that approach to not only work, but personal life, and just really thinking about like, where am I putting my priorities and why? And are there certain things that are causing me stress that are in my control that I can just get rid of? You know, obviously you don't want to like fire all of your clients and have no work. But if there's one situation that's especially problematic, it would be pretty high priority for me to, you know, think of a way out of that.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting thing for everybody to think about. Because I remember I had a client for several years that I should have let go long before. And it was just that the volume was high and I was kind of in a groove working with them. I knew what they wanted. I could turn things around quickly. And it was such a stressor. Just the way that they communicated, like you said, like the way that they worked, it was just... It seemed like every time you open your email, there was a fire to put out, and it had nothing to do with you many times. But it was always on their end, like, oh, we need this too. And this is, you know, like something last minute or whatever. Right. And then your entire day gets shifted. So yeah, I get it. Yeah. So, let's shift a little bit too. We've been talking sort of about professional and personal life here. But we wanted to talk to you about what we know has been a difficult chapter in your life, but one that you've clearly triumphed over. And we know that you're very open to sharing about it. And we think your story is not just inspiring for a lot of us, but also it's really important, especially right now, during Breast Cancer Awareness Month. So can you share with us the story of your battle with breast cancer?
So I guess to start, just to give some background for anyone listening who I don't know personally, I'm on what's considered a pretty young side of your average breast cancer patient. I originally kind of felt like something was off. I guess I would say I originally started investigating my situation when I was 31 years old. And then I was diagnosed when I was 32. So to put it lightly, breast cancer was not on my radar.
No, of course not. I mean, I remember when it happened and I was so shocked. I think I just sat there for like an hour, like on and off thinking, this can't be right. This is not possible. Like, did I read that correctly? Yes, this is really happening. It was so crazy. I remember.
Yeah. Yeah. And
And it wasn't even me. So, I mean, you can't even imagine on, you know, for you what you must have felt like.
Right. A lot of it was kind of like, why me? You know, a lot of it is still very much an internal kind of mental battle of why. But so it was not on my radar. I would have described myself as a, you know, a very healthy early 30-year-old woman, very active, ate well. You know, there was nothing I was doing that after the fact my doctor said, well, because you did this, you got breast cancer. I'm not perfect, you know. Of course, there's always things somebody can do to have a healthier lifestyle. But overall, I would say I was doing pretty well. Breast cancer was not a concern. I had no other medical concerns whatsoever. I guess long story short, I had found something on a self-exam and kind of was really shocked. And in the past at the doctors, I had, you know, during annual visits, I had said things like, oh, you know, someone in my immediate family had breast cancer within the last like 5 or so years. But I'd always been told kind of like, oh, well, that doesn't put you at higher risk because they were postmenopausal, they were, you know, mid-60s, and you know, that doesn't put you in a category of, you know, someone who needs to be monitored extra closely or anything like that. And it turns out that as far as we know, there is no connection between me and anyone else in my family. It's not thought to be like a family connection. So it's not like a genetic thing or anything like that. As far as we know with current genetics research, my case was not related to anyone else in my family.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah, so basically I went to get it investigated, and unfortunately I was not really taken seriously by my doctors. Kind of brushed off as too young, and I had never really had any medical encounters before besides your standard, you know, checkups and whatnot. My first reaction was really just to take their word for it and trust them. Luckily they did. When I did initially go in, they did actually take me seriously enough to give me a biopsy, actually. But it was kind of under this guise of like, we'll give you a biopsy, but it's nothing type thing. Yeah. Like they were almost already telling me that it wasn't cancer, even though they were going to do a biopsy. And that came back negative, which we still don't really know why.
Oh, I didn't know that part. Okay.
Yeah. So the biopsy came back negative, and I thought, oh, great. Like I'm off the hook.
Yeah.
This is awesome. You know, that whole process was only a couple months of really being worried, and I thought I was fine. But things progressively got worse. I now know that I had two tumors, actually, and they just kept getting bigger and bigger. And I started having other symptoms, like I had like back pain and all sorts of things. And eventually I just thought, you know, being me who I'm not used to like standing up to people or telling a medical professional that I think they're wrong. Like that's very much outside of my comfort zone. But sure. I had to say something. Something was just not right. And I felt like from the beginning, doctors had just decided that it wasn't cancer. And so, yeah. And so I went back and I said, you know, I don't know what this is. I know you keep telling me it's not cancer, but can you please just remove it? Because it's starting to impact my quality of life. I'm like almost in constant pain. I can't sleep anymore.
Wow.
Something needs to be done. So I had it surgically removed. And at that point, even, you know, even days leading up to that surgery, I'd been asking the surgeon, are you sure you don't, you know, like, what if this is cancer? Are you sure you don't want to biopsy at first? Like, are you sure? And he's just like, no, we'll just, you know, it's fine. We'll just take it out and you'll be fine. Good to go. And then, and then when the surgery came back from pathology, they said, oh, you know what, actually, this is cancer, and it's a very aggressive form of breast cancer that, you know, tends to be more common in younger folks. So
it tends to be more common. Wow. Because I was thinking they were telling you all this time, like, no, you're fine, because statistically, probably younger people, it's very rare, right?
Yes.
But this particular kind you're saying is more common in younger people.
Yes.
Wow. And so, that is crazy.
You know, I wish that I didn't have cancer in the first place, but I wish that when the doctor said, you know, I would like to think that they really believed that I didn't have cancer. But I wish that they had said, you know what, this probably isn't cancer, but just so you know, there is one type of cancer that's very commonly known to be like the young person's breast cancer, and that's what I had. And I had never heard of this cancer until I was diagnosed with it. And they said, oh yeah, this is the young person breast cancer, called triple negative breast cancer. It means it's not fueled by any type of hormones in your body. So I had never heard of triple negative until I was being told, you know, this is the young person breast cancer and this is what you have.
And you wouldn't have known that if you hadn't kept going back and saying something is not right.
Yeah.
Because they had told you twice that it was fine.
Yeah. I mean, I had only had one biopsy, so I guess only one official like pathology had said it was negative, but by any kind of like, you know, just manual exams or ultrasounds, most of those encounters, the doctors I saw were saying, like, this is probably nothing, but, you know, let's send you for this biopsy just in case.
Wow. And so there was a period of how many months between when you first realized something wasn't right and then finally, it was what? It was after an ATA conference that you told us about it. And I thought you must have been thinking about it even while we were there with you, maybe not that day or something, you know what I mean? But during that period of time when there's actually a lot going on, if anybody's ever been to an ATA conference and you're, you know, in a position like Megan, that was the year you joined the board, I think, right? You had just joined the board.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
I had so much going on in that period of time. I actually also got married during that time.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
So it was kind of like, oh my gosh. I mean, one of my first thoughts upon being diagnosed was like, I don't have time for cancer.
Yeah, yeah.
Which, you know, kind of goes into some deeper issues of like learning how to deal with things that are out of your control and letting go of perfectionism and things like that. But really, I felt like I don't have time for this.
I would have said the same thing, actually.
You know what? There's so much going on. And I was on the phone with one of my nurses who is, I mean, basically I got two phone calls. Number one was, you have cancer. Number two was like, here's what we're going to do about it. So the one good thing about that day was that I heard back right away, like what the plan was. So that was really nice that I wasn't like sitting there all night wondering. So on the second phone call, and they went through this kind of treatment plan with me, and I was writing it down and kind of looking like, okay, so they said like 5 months of chemo and then then surgery and then how many months of radiation or not months actually, luckily, but, I was adding it all up and thinking, wow, like I do not have time for this.
Yeah. And you had just gotten married. That's a whole new thing as well. Oh my gosh. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, by the time, so when I initially like felt something was off and went to see my doctor, that was in like July. And then, I wasn't officially diagnosed until late December, like a few days before Christmas. Mm-hmm. And yeah, for it, you know, every cancer situation is different, but in my case, that those few months actually did end up being quite a severe, like that's a pretty dangerous amount of time to let it go.
Especially with an aggressive form, I guess, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Mine was categorized as like the fastest growing on like a scale that it can be graded on. I could have told you that even without this score, like I could tell with my own heart.
Yeah. Yeah.
I knew that it was changing rapidly. That's why I went back. So it was getting very, very fast. Yeah. Wow.
Well, I mean, I think I've told you this before, not here, but I'm always amazed and impressed by people who advocate for their own health, because that does happen. You know, you might go to a doctor or something and you're like, something's just not right. And then they'll say, you know, no, it's fine. And because a lot of times they are thinking about statistics, right? I mean, statistically, this is very unusual, so it's probably fine. And that's, to an extent, good, right? Because you don't want a doctor who's like an alarmist or something like that about everything. But you do need somebody who's going to listen to you and take you seriously. So I'm I'm always like thankful for people who advocate for themselves, because I think a lot of people, I mean, I would have done the same thing as you the first time and said, oh, well, that's, you know, that's what they told me. Everything should be fine, you know, and move on.
I wanted to believe them.
And you want to, yeah.
I didn't want to have cancer, but yeah, ultimately I had to do something. And yeah, it was really, really far outside of my comfort zone. I do not like to rock the boat. Yeah. And so to go to a medical professional and say, like, I think you're wrong. But yeah, obviously, I honestly think that saved my life, because when I was diagnosed, they said it's this grade 3, which is very fast growing, and stage 3, which is very close to like spreading to my organs. Mm-hmm. So, if I'd waited any longer, I may not have been treatable.
Yeah. And for anybody who's listening that's not aware, I think, is it just, there's only 4 stages total, right? It's 1 through 4?
Yep. So at stage 4, in my case, I mean, I think I would have had some options if I had been, I think it's called de novo stage 4, is when on your initial diagnosis, when you're stage 4 right away. I think I would have had some options, but at that point, it's not considered like curable. Like, you're considered to kind of just be in more of a maintenance mode where you're trying to stop the progression to other organs, but it's not just in the breast area anymore. So it's really hard to like stop the spread.
Wow. So that's too close for comfort.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought I remembered, it's just 4 stages. Wow. So, well, obviously you're here with us, so
yeah.
you've had a good victory there, but I know that it took some time. So how has your victory in the battling cancer affected your work-life priorities? Because you've talked to us a little bit about this too.
Yeah, I would say it's really forced me to take a hard look at priorities with my time and my relationships, whether it's like work relationships or personal relationships. It's really forced me to just take a hard look at all of that and kind of step back and reevaluate. And I've seen overlap between our current, with the health pandemic, with that as well, is that you need to really think about the choices of what you're doing every day and why it's important to you, and you know, whether or not you're putting yourself at risk for things. I also wanted to touch on that, you know, as I've mentioned a couple times, I think a lot of us tend to be somewhat of perfectionists, myself included, and we like to have things in control. And you can only imagine how much like something like a cancer diagnosis is really throws all of that out of balance. You know, that feeling of not only do I not have time for this, but suddenly there's so much out of my control. There's so much that is so far from perfect. I think I really needed to reevaluate, like, how am I spending my time? Where am I putting my time and energy? And why is that important to me? I think, you know, it's definitely a work in progress, and it's something I can work on even when the pandemic is over, hopefully someday. Even when maybe cancer isn't as much on my radar anymore, but it's something that can apply, I would hope, for the rest of, you know, my work life and personal life, is just really thinking about how I'm spending my time and my energy, not feeling guilty for putting myself first, and also working with the concept of things not necessarily being guaranteed. And so do what you can with what you have now, because you don't know if it might change tomorrow.
That's a really hard and powerful lesson
to learn so young too. But I mean, good that you did too in the same time, so you don't spend years and years, you know, doing the opposite.
And you know, I think as a freelancer, it's odd, but I think it's odd to phrase it this way, but I think cancer really helped me acknowledge one of my weak spots in my business, and that was definitely adapting to change and accepting things that are outside of my control. That was absolutely a weak spot. I think as someone who worked as a project manager for a while, I definitely had like a fine like foundation of you know, working with sudden changes in projects and, you know, prioritizing emails that might come out of the blue, all that kind of stuff. I think that was fine. I wasn't terrible at it, but I guess having something so dramatic, I wasn't quite ready for that much of a change where it's like, suddenly everything is not what you thought it was and you have to start from scratch. I wouldn't say my, you know, my plan and my experience was rock solid enough to feel like I was ready for that kind of overhaul. So
I don't know that you can be ready for something like that.
Right. I mean, and I wouldn't say that we should be, you know, preparing ourselves for a major health crisis at any moment. But in some ways, like going through that experience really helped me, I guess, just admit it to myself that, hey, you know, I need to work on this. I need to work on, you know, hopefully I won't have another big crazy scare. But like, what are some things that I can strengthen in my day-to-day work process that just makes me feel a little more like solid with things that, you know, might pop up suddenly.
Mm. That's a good lesson. Yeah.
So what role has your support system played in the process? And have you learned something along the way that continues to be important for you now that you are cancer-free?
Yeah, I would say it was difficult to ask for help. And I know in my friend group, I may have, being so young, being in my early 30s, I know for a lot of my friends, I may have been the first person they knew that was their age and going through this type of health crisis. And so it was difficult for me to not only ask for help, but also I think sometimes people didn't quite know what to offer. Mm-hmm. Luckily, I was very lucky to have some friends who just knew what to do and did it. And that was super, super helpful. And I think I've learned from that how to kind of be a better support system in the future for friends who may need it. So things like, and I would have, if I had never gotten sick, but I had a friend who maybe was going through a tough time, I think a lot of us, our reflex is to send a text or something that says, let me know how I can help. That's a really, really well-intentioned text. And I really think they mean well, and they love you and care about you, but it's not extremely helpful to the person who needs your help, because then it's putting kind of like a burden on them to assign you a task. And so it's kind of this, this cycle of somebody really wants to help, but they don't know how. And then the person who needs help is sitting there like, oh my gosh, like, I just remember feeling so weighed down by keeping track of appointments and medications. And, you know, I was on chemo for many months and just feeling absolutely exhausted. And I just having to think of a chore for a friend, which already is a little bit uncomfortable to ask for.
Yeah.
To think of a chore and then, you know, assign it to them and schedule a time and a day. It felt like way too much for me to handle. Mm-hmm. So luckily I've learned that a really helpful kind of alternative to that is I loved it when friends would just say, hey, you know, I made dinner for my family and we purposefully made like, you know, a few extra servings. We're going to package it up and drop it off at this time. If you're not home, you know, we'll just leave it. Or even if you're home and you don't feel like coming to the door because you're just too tired or not feeling well, we're just going to leave it. Otherwise, if you do want to say hi for a minute, you know, we're happy to come in and chat. Things like that were just awesome. A lot of the times, honestly, when I was home, I wasn't up for socializing. And that made me feel guilty again for not being like a good host. And just having someone say, hey, you don't have to lift a finger. Here's some food. Or, you know, I went to the grocery store, text me, or I'm at the grocery store, text me if you need anything and I'll pick it up. Mm-hmm. Like that, where someone really takes that super extra initiative, made a world of difference in things that, you know, in my day-to-day life prior to cancer, I wouldn't have thought that, you know, grocery shopping isn't very hard. I actually really like it. I really miss it right now in the pandemic. Or, you know, cooking, I love cooking. So normally I wouldn't feel like cooking is a burden. But during those times, it was like, Oh my gosh, I can't even like chop a vegetable right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, let alone make a decision for somebody to do something for you that you don't feel comfortable asking them in the first place.
Yeah. Yeah. So having those friends was just, oh my gosh, such a huge help. And my mother-in-law did a lot of help that I didn't have to ask for as well. And yeah, I hope that, I hope that I don't have to pass on that help, but you know, ultimately I'm sure those lessons will come in handy when they're needed in the future. So now I know how to better support people who may need it.
Yeah. Something that I was thinking about when you were going through all that, because I remember you mentioned that people had dropped off food or gotten some groceries or whatever. And I thought, I wish I were local because I can't really do a whole lot from far away. But then I thought there must be something. And I don't remember now because it's been a while. But if I had said, you know, like if you need help with ATA stuff or something like that, I don't know, because you had a lot going on. But it's always hard when you're far away from that person because you're like, what can I do that's not going to give them more work? You know, that's not going to be a burden on them later or something like that. But I was so impressed. You literally, I never saw you miss a beat. You know, for anybody listening, Megan's on one of my committees and in ATA, and she never missed a meeting. And I was like, wow, okay. So I knew you were going through a lot of stuff, but you really held it together for the rest of us. Like, I was so impressed. I was just like waiting for you to say, I can't make it or something like that. And I would have been, of course, like, don't worry about it, you know, but you never did. You were always there. So I thought that was really commendable because I did not expect that. I don't think anybody did.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I guess for me, it's different for everybody, but for me, it did help to have some sort of, this is actually something I wanted to touch on a bit, was the whole idea of normal. And I was going to say, any sense of normalcy was something I was kind of embracing because it would just help me focus on things that weren't just cancer, you know, rolling around my brain all the time. But in the same sense, I think I'm trying to stay away from ideas of like what is normal or expected and more reframe it as like the current reality and how can we adapt to it. But in any case, yeah, I was happy to just have other things that I knew were fulfilling and that I could, you know, still help with things that I thought were important. So yeah, I was happy that I was still able to do those things.
Well, let's talk about habits for a little bit. Were there any habits or routines, and you named a few earlier, but what other habits have you found most helpful during your battle with cancer?
One that was severely overlooked in my case that has been immensely helpful is sleep habits. And I know you've touched on this before in the podcast, and I'm happy that you did. I'm happy to reemphasize it again. Sleep habits are just so, so important. I've learned to really, I don't have like a strict bedtime per se, but I'm really, I guess, thinking about like, would staying up and watching this episode of XYZ show, would that bring me more like positive results than actually just going to bed earlier? And a lot of times that answer is no, like bed is what I need. So things like creating a better like sleep environment have been really helpful. I have this a little bit of a routine, I guess I could call it, where I put on like a classical music station on like a timer. I have a radio, like a clock radio in the bedroom that does Bluetooth, but it also has radio. So it has like the best of both worlds, like the old school and the new school, because I do still listen to actual radio. But I also listen to Bluetooth a lot as well. So I put on this classical radio station, and then I have like an oil diffuser, and I often use the app Calm to do like a sleep meditation or like a body relaxation. And those are things, again, that I never would have like not thought those were nice things, but at the same time, I really never made a priority of practicing them on a regular basis. My sleep has been it was something that was really terrible when I was in treatment, especially chemotherapy. I had a very, very rough time getting a good night's sleep during chemo, just with all the different medications I was on. And then there's a lot of things, you know, that you cycle through your head at night that keep you awake and you can't turn your brain off. That was a really big challenge for me. And so when I started to try out these little routines at night, mm-hmm. and slowly seeing my sleep improve, that was like such a win in my book, because there was so many little everyday things in my everyday life that I had to kind of like give up or couldn't enjoy anymore. And so to be able to kind of reclaim something as basic as sleep that I felt had been so heavily impacted, that was just amazing. And so now I really prioritize that because I know how valuable it is.
Definitely. So what kind of habits besides sleep, what habits are you working on right now? And have you made any lifestyle or work changes, not necessarily as a result of your experience with battling breast cancer, but just in general, have you had to change anything maybe because of the pandemic or for any reason?
Yeah, I think I am working on, and I like that this is another thing that you've touched on in the podcast, is I wouldn't say that I have a great deal of what we would call like traditional imposter syndrome, but I definitely am guilty of kind of just like being my own biggest critic, being too hard on myself, being really critical about, you know, like, oh, you didn't get enough done today. Mm-hmm. And that can really, I think, snowball over time. And so I am trying to unlearn some of that. And sometimes it's helpful for me to, I like lists a lot. I use the app Todoist. And sometimes I look at my list of what I'd like to get done for the day. And I think, okay, I'm going to try to do at least, you know, one or two of these things that are marked as very high priority. And I'll see what I get to for the rest. Yeah. And if I, you know, if I don't get to those, it's okay. You know, deadlines aren't going to get missed if I break things down into these like manageable chunks. And it's okay to maybe start something one day and not finish it. So that's kind of like a habit I'm trying to get into, is just, yeah, not being too hard on myself about like productivity levels, especially with the pandemic right now. I think a lot of us could probably relate to this feeling of maybe more so towards the beginning of lockdown, especially of like, where did the last week go? And now if I try and think back, did I get enough done? So it's definitely a balance, and it's a work in progress of thinking like, okay, I'd like to get this done, but really I shouldn't be hard on myself if I need to delay this to the next day. So I think that's been extremely helpful for me in order to still feel productive, but not to an unhealthy level where I'm holding myself to unrealistic expectations. More into the personal life stuff, this year, 2020, was kind of what I had hoped would be this like big comeback year for my personal life, in terms of like, I like to be really active. And so I had all sorts of plans. You know, I had a trip to France, and I had like a breast cancer retreat that I was going to go to in Pennsylvania. And then the big activity I was really excited for, I mean, France, those other two ones were great too, but the big kind of new, trying something new that I was going to do was I was going to go on a whitewater kayaking trip for a week in Montana with a group of cancer survivors. And, you know, that was all booked. And so it was tough to kind of be like, okay, 2020 is my year. And then boom, it all gets shut down. That was tough, but it did teach me that once again, you know, this is an opportunity to step back, like live more in the moment, and just do what I can with the current situation, and like learn how to kind of fall back in love with just really simple things that maybe I couldn't enjoy last year. So, you know, like gardening, I've been doing a lot more gardening this year, and just like little things that I kind of took for granted pre-cancer, but I can kind of enjoy again now. And they don't require, you know, traveling to France per se. Yeah. So that's been something I've just been learning to appreciate more just in everyday little things.
Yeah. And I can say that your garden is very impressive. Megan's been growing everything and like really well.
Yeah. Oh man. Well, we had some great amounts of sun here in Wisconsin this summer. So
that's awesome. So we have one more question for you. Do you have any advice for other freelancers who might be in a similar situation with a serious illness or maybe just preventative steps that you would like to share with people?
Yeah, of course. The number one thing prevention-wise is just to remember that you know your own body. And even if you have zero medical experience, you know your body. You're the one, you know, living in it every day. And if something's off, I would do everything possible to get it investigated properly. I would say there's no such thing as being too young for cancer, breast cancer included. And the best thing we can do really is do self-exams. So those are recommended on a monthly basis. The reason being that if you are doing regular exams, you will feel very confident when something doesn't feel right, because right. It doesn't feel like it did every other month. So that way, that kind of empowers you to go to your doctor and say, you know, I do this every month. This definitely does not feel the same as it always does. That's the best thing we can do, honestly, until there is a cure for breast cancer, is just speak up. Mammograms, I didn't really know this prior to my experience, but I thought, oh, you know, this is stupid. Why is the magic number for mammograms like age 40 or 45 when people like are getting extremely aggressive breast cancer way before then? The reason, as far as I understand, is like the way the imaging works of a mammogram, like the image doesn't read breast tissue as well at younger ages, because your tissue develops over time, it changes. And so I guess that age range of 40, 45 is kind of the standard of when the mammogram images actually are considered to be more effective. Of my basic understanding of it, of, you know, because I thought, well, why don't they do them younger?
Right.
So for that reason, because apparently mammograms aren't super effective on younger folks such as myself, it really is one of our first lines of defense is just to do self-exams, and it's really simple, and it could save your life. So
keep up with doctor's appointments, keep up with self-exams. That's a right. Very good piece of advice.
So I'd like to share a few calls to action for any listeners who might want to get involved. So first of all, if you know somebody who's going through treatment for breast cancer, one of the easiest ways to just immediately have an impact is to participate in a meal train if they have one, or GoFundMe, or you can simply just, check in, send them a card or a text. They'll really appreciate it. Once it's safe to do so again, I would recommend maybe driving them to the hospital or spending time with them when they get treatment. Sometimes that can take a really long time at the hospital, so it's nice to have some company. You could also offer a gift card. There's a lot of really helpful services that might not be covered by insurance. So this could be like massage, acupuncture, yoga or meditation, physical therapy, or even home cleaning services. You could also donate your time or items to hospitals and cancer treatment centers. So some examples of items that might be helpful for breast cancer patients would be scarves, wigs, hats, blankets, makeup, and other personal care items. Then if you would like to donate financially, you can give directly to many organizations. Some focus more on research to find a cure for breast cancer, and others provide support services for people going through breast cancer. Both are really a great way to show your support. There are a ton of options out there, but just some that I'm familiar with that I would recommend would be the Triple Negative Breast Cancer Foundation, Young Survival Coalition, Breast Cancer Research Foundation, Metaviver, Living Beyond Breast Cancer, and After Breast Cancer Diagnosis. Again, those are just a few that I personally know. Finally, in October, a lot of us see very visible products and campaigns for what is called breast cancer awareness. One thing I would recommend is to do just a little bit of research to find out what exactly these campaigns are doing and if they are actually giving proceeds to a specific organization. And I would really just encourage making sure that any kind of financial contribution is going directly to either research or support services for people going through breast cancer. And no matter what you decide to do, it's always appreciated, and thanks for getting involved.
Wow. So many important takeaways and reminders just throughout this conversation. Thank you so much, Megan. It's been amazing to learn more about your journey and how you went through this and just hear all these important lessons. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks for having me on, and I'm happy to share.
Thank you. It's an honor to have you. And now it's time for a popular segment, What's on Your Desk? And we're really excited that you decided to join us for this. So in this segment, we share various objects, tools, resources, gadgets that we find useful and we want to recommend to our colleagues. So Megan, what would you like to recommend to our listeners?
So I really like an app called 1 Second Every Day. And what it does is it takes very short videos. I don't know if it's actually 1 second. I think it is 1 second. But it takes very short videos of whatever. You do it manually. So you choose what you want to take a video of. And then it loops them all together into however long of a video you'd like. So the idea is, I've seen some people use it for like kids, for example. So they'll take these little mini videos every day, and then you can kind of see a sped up version of your kid growing up, which is really cool. So what I've been using it for, and I also really like that on days when I may not remember to do it, because I would like to try and have kind of a clip from every day. But what I like is that it also gives me the option to just kind of take a clip from either, if I happen to record a video for some other reason that day, it'll say, hey, do you want to take a clip of this? And this will be kind of like your memory for the day. Or I could do a photo as well if I don't happen to have a video. But the reason I wanted to do it, I started it on January 1st. And I really kind of, as I mentioned, like 2020 was going to be like my comeback year or whatever. And it's fine that it's, very different from what I thought 2020 would be, but that's okay. I'm using it more of like it's kind of like a gratitude journal in a way, where I try to remember, like I said, like appreciating the little things in every day and just little things that I really don't want to take for granted. And so if I appreciate something and I happen to have my phone, on me, I'll just take a little video, like in my garden or, of the dog or something. And so at the end of the year, the idea is that I'll have this video of kind of like a whole year of gratitude moments.
I think it's an important year to do that. I think this is a year where a lot of people probably felt they should document something, but it's been so crazy that they're like, oh, forget it.
Yeah.
And this is going to be a year that's just like, you tell the grandkids about, it's like very, very unusual, but I think looking at it from a gratitude perspective is nice.
Yeah, that's great, because I don't necessarily, I mean, it's important to remember the bad parts too, but I don't want that to like outweigh all the good things. So that seems like a good way to focus on the positive and things you're grateful for. That's really cool. So I wanted to share about an app as well. It's an app I've heard of from Sarah Marie Husband. She was on our episode 14, and she shared about it in her Instagram, Miss Linguistic. It's an app called Drops, and I never heard of it before, but then I tried it and I loved it, and I use it with my kids now. So it's a language learning app. It's very minimalistic, and it's also very, just visually very pleasant. Nothing overwhelming, nothing crazy. You can like modify whether you want daily daily reminders. You can set a timer, say, you can say, I want to practice a language for 5 minutes every day. And you can set a timer for 5 minutes and set a reminder. So the app tells you, you know, this is time to practice or whatever. And so I've used it alone. I've used it with my kids. My husband is French, so I found it a good way for me and the kids to have an activity together and, you know, practice French. I also use it with them in Russian. I personally like to brush up on my Norwegian. I really like learning, like right now I'm learning Danish through this app. So it's really cool. You can pick a topic that you would like to get the words and like phrases from. And then you basically have to like drag and drop the correct answer into correct like image of what this represents. So somehow I guess there must be some brain science behind it that, you know, helps you remember words and phrases easier. But I also find it very like minimal effort, something fun to break up the day and a fun activity to do with the kids. So that's something I recommend. What about you, Madalena?
That's cool. You should share that, by the way, with Eve Baudu.
Yes.
Yeah. About learning second languages or maintaining your second languages. Yeah. So mine's also an app. Have you two heard of the app called Voxer?
No.
V-O-X-E-R. Okay. So you probably know sort of what Slack is, right? Slack, you know, is one of those kind of apps you can either have on your desktop or on your phone, and you can communicate with teams remotely about any kind of thing. Some people use it within their family even, but other people use it like with remote teams, or I've used it in my courses and stuff. But Voxer is different because Voxer is like sort of like a walkie-talkie app. So it's mostly voice related. So if let's say that we were working on a project together, I could send you, I think I can also send a text through it, but I could send, let's say I could send Megan a voice message in real time and say, hey, well, what do you think about this? So rather than her having to check her email and think about it and get back to me, she can just say, yeah, I think that's great. Or you should change this or something like that. And you can do video with it, send photos. You could share your location. It's just really cool. And it does kind of remind you of the old school walkie-talkies a little bit. But it's also nice to have, I guess, sometimes, I mean, it's always good to have a visual thing, like with your email or something, but sometimes you don't need it for everything, right? And it just feels like one more message you've got to deal with, or your inbox just keeps piling up. Whereas this is, you check it when you can, and you can get back to somebody rather quickly because you don't actually have to, you know, type anything or text anything, and It's very cool. So I think they have like a free 30-day trial or something, but it's an interesting app.
Nice. Cool.
Yeah. So we'll share those in our show notes, of course, too. So thanks, Megan, for joining us today again. And we really appreciated having you for this conversation. We know that your story is going to continue to positively impact the lives of other people who hear it. And before we go, we want to ask you, where can our listeners learn more about you or find you online?
So my website is fr-en.com. And then I am on Twitter at Megan, M-E-G-H-A-N, _translate. So it's T-R-A-N-S-L number 8.
Oh, the number 8. Okay.
Yep. And I'm happy to keep in touch with anyone out there. So
wonderful. Well, we'll put that in the show notes. And thanks again for joining us today.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks so much for having me and just giving me the opportunity to share my experience.
Thank you for sharing it, because I know that's not always the easiest thing to do. So that's it for this week's episode. Next week, we'll be sending our email subscribers a summary of today's episode with a link to the show notes so you can quickly find all the resources that we mentioned today. And if you'd like to receive our emails, please sign up on our website at smarthabitsfortranslators.com.
And if you like our podcast, there are a couple of simple ways you can show your support. You can share the podcast with your colleagues and friends who may be interested in it, and you can leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. This only takes a minute, and we have recorded a quick video tutorial to show you how to do it. We'll link it in the show notes. Our next episode will be released on November 3rd, when we'll share some smart habits for marketing online in unexpected places.
Talk to you soon. We hope you enjoyed this episode and discovered a simple strategy that you can apply today at work or at home to help you achieve the lifestyle you desire. If you did, please let us know. We'd love to hear from you.
If you have a topic you want us to cover on this podcast, please record a quick voice message and email it to us at hello at smarthabitsfortranslators.com. If you like this episode, please leave us a rating wherever you listen to podcasts, and please share the podcast with other translators you know.